From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2. Me, Martinez. LA's mountain lions face a dangerous road if they try to cross the 101 freeway, but now plans are in the works for a land bridge that could save them from extinction. Plus, what kind of training is required to become a map editor for the traffic app Waze?
Traffic is a really complex engineering problem that shouldn't be given to guys with names like Dwarf Lord.
It's all ahead on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. Thanks for choosing us for your Tuesday listening. And for the hundreds of thousands of LAUSD parents who dropped off their kids for the first day of school today, congratulations for getting your mid-mornings and early afternoons back. See, now you can head back to the gym without having to rush through your workout, maybe get a little brunch after that. And actually, considering what time it is right now, you are probably heading to or waiting at the pickup line. So just relax and let your pals here at Take 2 get you in the news flow on everything you need to know. All right, coming up, we're going to hear how climate change is threatening California wine, specifically Cabernet. Plus, Los Angeles-based comedian Adam Conover joins us in studio. First, though, our local wildlife. Now, did you know that we're one of the only two megacities in the world that can say they have a big cat living within city limits? Mumbai has its leopards, but LA, yeah, we've got our mountain lions. Now, according to a study published this year by UCLA, UC Davis, and the National Park Service, our mountain lion population faces extinction in 15 years because of inbreeding and habitat loss. And some people are now saying that a land bridge is needed to enable the big cats to connect with other populations and diversify. Beth Pratt is executive director of the California Regional Center for the Wildlife Federation. She's at the site of the future bridge now. Beth, welcome to Take 2.
Hey, thanks for having me. And yeah, I'm standing here in the beautiful Santa Monica Mountains. I have butterflies flying around me. Ooh. I have beautiful hills, but I also have a freeway that I'm looking at that I wouldn't even want to try to cross, you know, let alone if you're a coyote or a mountain lion.
Yeah, that's the challenge, right, for the mountain lion, specifically mountain lion. So, okay, tell us where the land bridge is and what it'll look like.
Yeah, so the Santa Monica Mountains, if on the 101 in a beautiful town called Agora Hills, there is open space that the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy has worked for decades to preserve. And the site of the crossing has been identified by many scientists and planning agencies as the most critical linkage in the region to preserve for wildlife. And indeed, it's the only one left. There is 1,600 feet here left where there is protected space on both sides of the freeway. So this is our last shot to reconnect this ecosystem for mountain lions, which are most at risk at this point, but for all wildlife, because the mountain lions are getting hit and genetically collapsing, but the same research that the National Park Service does shows that it's also happening to birds and reptiles. And so it's not just about the big megafauna, although we love them. And, of course, P22 is our celebrity cat.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, so when is it slated to be up and running?
So if we stay on track with fundraising, and that's my job through the Save LA Cougars campaign to get this funded for Caltrans. Caltrans is like, we'll build it. Just get us the funding. And we've stayed on track. We've hit every fundraising target so far from the support of the community and state agencies. But we're on track to break ground in 2021, which is, you know, I've been working on this a long time.
Yeah, wow.
It's not that far away. So we're getting there, and it should be complete by 2023.
Why has it taken so long, Beth? We've needed it for a long time, right?
Yeah. So it's interesting. You know, corridor science and wildlife crossings are kind of, you know, if not new, it's sort of emerging. And California is a little behind the rest of the world or the country where there are some. In some respects, this project is racing ahead. I've worked on public projects my whole career. And since we did the feasibility study, which came out in 2015, to have a public-private project of this magnitude be done in 10 years, you know, or just about, that's actually fast. And as you can imagine, it's a big project. You have, it's a 10-lane freeway and access road. You know, I mean, looking into the engineering, which I'm having to learn more transportation engineering terms, you know, that I ever wanted to know, but it's a huge project to engineer. Caltrans has a process, and we're grateful to them because in some respects they've been fast-tracking this for us because of the need. We're running out of time with the mountain lions.
Yeah, and most people agree. I mean, bipartisan support almost for this land bridge that it is needed for the mountain lions. We're talking to Beth Pratt, Executive Director of the California Regional Center for the Wildlife Federation. I don't imagine, Beth, that it'll be an exclusive club just for mountain lions. What other critters maybe stand to benefit from it?
So just about any critter that needs to get across the road will benefit. And I think that the larger issue, though, is you're reconnecting an entire ecosystem, right? I mean, the 101 essentially has cut off the Santa Monica Mountains from the rest of the world in some respects. You know, you got the coast and then it's all freeways. So it's, you know, the mountain lions are our poster child because who doesn't love cats? But you're reconnecting an ecosystem that for decades has been separated. So you think of quail or, you know, alligator lizards or the smaller mammals that, although you know, we don't think of them as needing to get across the road, they also can't be isolated. So we'll see just about everything that needs to move in this area probably use this, even if they don't go across the whole bridge.
Now, Beth, let's imagine, let's put ourselves in the future when the bridge is finally open and animals are using it, and specifically mountain lions for this question. What kind of effect will it have on their population? I mean, I could imagine it's all positive, right?
Yeah, I mean, we are not, this is not about bringing more mountain lions here. In fact, it's not. There are mountain lions here already. And mountain lions are extremely self-regulating. They live in territories. They fight to the death over it. They live alone. It's about ensuring they don't go extinct. So this isn't about opening the doors for more wildlife. In fact, we're just allowing wildlife to move normally, large or small. So it's just about maintaining an ecosystem. But what I can't wait is for the first, you know, we'll have cameras on this, for the first videos to come out of a mountain lion crossing. Oh, it's going to give you the chills. And indeed, you can look at, there's crossings like the Banff crossings. You know, they have feeds. And if you look at, there's wolves using those and grizzly bears. And it's wonderful to see those photos.
All right.
And also, like you said, it's bipartisan. We enjoy, you know, the National Wildlife Federation, we're working on national corridor legislation right now that is supported bipartisan. There's something that unifies us about getting wildlife across the road because we can solve it. We know how to solve it.
One more quick thing, Beth, in the time we have left. This has been a long time in the making. Is one enough? Mm-hmm. Do we need more of these throughout the region?
You know, we do. And I'm not stopping with this one, and neither are our partners. You need a, you know, we're looking at the 5 and the 126, and then Dr. Winston Vickers, another mountain lion biologist, the 15 is having the same effect. But what we know from years of study, as you're saying, is that the 101 is the most critical barrier in this area right now. We fix this one, and we go on to the next one. But yes, it's not about, you need a regional approach to this. And the good news is Caltrans is supportive of doing that as well.
Beth Pratt, Regional Executive Director of the California Regional Center for the Wildlife Federation. Beth, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right, moving on. A judge dealt another blow Monday in an ongoing case against L.A. County Sheriff's Department. Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Mitchell Beckloff overturned Sheriff Alex Villanueva's controversial decision to reinstate Deputy Carl Mandoyan. Mandoyan was fired in 2016, and Villanueva attempted to rehire the deputy late last year. The dispute has created friction between L.A. County Board of Supervisors and the sheriff. Now, to get us up to speed, we have reporter Matt Stiles. He's been covering this for the L.A. Times. Matt, welcome back to Take Two.
Hi, good to be here.
Now, to give listeners some context, let's revisit Sheriff Villanueva's original actions to set this whole battle in motion. He rehired Deputy Carl Mandoyan after he was terminated for violating policies on domestic violence and lying. So tell us what their relationship was like prior to that and why Villanueva chose to bring Mandoyan back.
Well, the relationship is, the complete telling of it is still a mystery, but we do know that they're close, that they may have worked together in a South L.A. station years ago, and we know that Mandoyan helped with Villanueva's election, making calls for him, driving him around. And we also know that at a critical moment recently for Villanueva, when he was sworn in as sheriff and he pinned hardware on his top executives in the department, Mandoyan was at his side helping him hand out those ceremonial pins. So we know that Mandoyan's very close to him. We just don't know exactly how that influenced this decision by Villanueva.
Now, how did the L.A. County Board of Supervisors react to the rehiring?
So at first they expressed concern about it, and then I think they decided they wanted to get more aggressive, and they found a lawyer who would help them challenge it in court. So they took it to court, essentially arguing that once someone is sort of completely fired from the county, as Mandoyan had been, he had appealed to the Civil Service Commission, had lost that appeal, then if that person is to be rehired, they have to start from scratch and basically go through the county's personnel director and can't be rehired by the sheriff directly. And so they're arguing this not necessarily on the facts of Mandoyan's behavior or his disciplinary history, but on the sort of HR rules governing the county.
So in a nutshell, they're saying that the sheriff's rehiring of Mandoyan was unlawful?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now, yesterday, Judge Beckloff ruled that Villanueva did not have the authority to reinstate Mandoyan. What are the next legal steps here?
So the next legal step would be a trial. So what the judge ruled was basically saying that that Mandoyan shouldn't be serving as a deputy right now, that it could cause harm to the county, and that the county, if they go forward with the case, seems likely or has a good case to prevail at trial. But there still could be a trial. There could be some sort of settlement of this before then. But then we would find out finally whether Mandoyan would be allowed to stay, whether he would be allowed to get some back pay for the time in which he has not been paid. And then that might also, the result of the trial might also settle a little bit of this power struggle between the Board of Supervisors and Villanueva. Whoever doesn't win the trial may feel that the other has made their point about their independent political power.
In the immediate time right now, will Mandoyan be allowed to be a deputy, or does he have to turn in his badge and gun for the time being?
He has to turn in his badge, his gun, and his uniform. And the judge said both he and Villanueva are prohibited from holding him out as a deputy. He cannot refer to himself as a deputy. The sheriff cannot refer to him as a deputy. So for all intents and purposes, he's just a resident of L.A. County right now.
And considering, though, how dug in Villanueva seems to be on this, is he going to just go with this for the time being?
I believe so. I mean, he put out a statement yesterday that was somewhat conciliatory. He said that he would abide by the judge's ruling, and he also said that he remains hopeful and optimistic that he can work with the Board of Supervisors on other issues, other pressing issues that the Sheriff's Department faces. So we'll see how this plays out going forward. And, you know, there are also other cases, not just like Mandoyan's, but cases in which deputies have been fired or disciplined, in which the sheriff has reinstated him. And a lot of those, the questions raised in those cases have not even been brought up by the supervisor. So this is not just about Mandoyan. It's about the sheriff's disciplinary moves overall going forward.
We're talking to Matt Stiles from the LA Times. It seems the sheriff's actions to make the department more independent from oversight may be backfiring. How has the sheriff handled this?
Some might argue sloppily. I think you're speaking about the Office of Inspector General and the potential criminal investigation into some of the people who are supposed to oversee his department over personnel records and that. He's been criticized for, starting a criminal investigation against civilian oversight employees, and we'll see whether that criticism leads to some, penalty for him, or whether this continues to erode his, political support.
Well, let's get into that political support. Yeah, because the Board of Supervisors, at least his relationship with the Board of Supervisors, seems to have soured over this tug of war. What sense are you getting from the board about their current stance toward the sheriff?
I feel like the supervisors are, any chance that in the near term that they would be gracious towards him or work closely with him in public, it's just getting more and more difficult to see that as a possibility. The other day, the sheriff came in to speak about the need for mental health, resources in the jails, something everyone sort of agrees on. And he was speaking and telling a story about a specific case, and the chair of the Board of Supervisors, Janice Hahn, just interrupted him out of the blue and said, "Does this story have an ending?"
Oof,
and a very, kind of embarrassing moment for the sheriff, and, you know, just not something you really see. There's normally a lot of comedy around the dais at the supervisors' meetings. So there's that. I think there's just an underlying tension there related to the Mandoyan case, the way the sheriff's responded to it, and also just the nature of the charges that Mandoyan was accused of, you know, involving domestic violence.
All right, that's Matt Stiles from the LA Times bringing us up to date on LA County Sheriff's Department and a case involving a former deputy. Matt, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Good to be here.
All right, Cabernet is really what put California firmly, firmly on the worldwide wine map, specifically Napa Valley. Thing is, though, climate change is really doing a number on the grapes here, so much so that some winemakers are preparing for a near future without Cabernet in California. That's right, they're actually thinking that Cabernet might not be around in California much longer. Find out what action one of them is taking when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds, so stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The California Cabernet could be a wine in decline, and that's because of climate change. As weather patterns shift and extreme droughts and rains become more frequent in the state, some winemakers are thinking about how to provide for the toasts of the future. Dan Petrosky is one of them. He's with Larkmead Vineyard in Napa County. He's taken several steps to figure out what grapes can best weather climate change and what kinds of wines they'll produce. He's on the line now. Hi.
Appreciate it.
Dan, when did you first start to think that climate change is a problem that you'd have to confront head on?
Back in 2008, 2009, when I came to the Napa Valley, I was put on a task force with the Napa Valley Vintners to look at climate and to look at the changes we were going to anticipate and the changes we had over the course of the last 20 years. We were doing this in response to some research that came out. One noted climatologist from the Pacific Northwest, a gentleman named Greg Jones, but he was like, the best wine grapes are going to be grown in the Rocky Mountains come the 2050s. You know, so we're sitting there, that's 40-odd years away. We're looking at that going, well, the best wine grapes in America are grown in Napa Valley. So I don't think there was a sense of urgency back then, but I think we're starting to see, in the last decade, with these extremes that we've had to deal with the wildfires and earthquakes and rainfall and drought, I think we're starting to see that this is it's coming up quicker than we anticipated. So there's a little bit more of a sense of urgency today.
So mention the steps that you're trying to figure out on your grapes. What kind of things are you doing?
We decided to start looking at the future and started planting vineyards to identify what our anticipations are going to be. So Cabernet is a great grape for this region at this time, but I'm not sure, based on what we're seeing, it'll be a great grape in the future.
So Dan, when you say that Cabernet may be not a great wine for California's future, why not?
Cabernet Sauvignon does really well because of its structure and its fruitfulness and its power and its generosity on the palate. When you start to bring in variable climate, where it's the shortening of the grape growing season and, you know, intense heat or record rainfall, you're going to be creating variables that Cabernet is not necessarily used to here in California. And I worry about that being something that, you know, you're not going to be able to mature and ripen Cabernet at a level that we're accustomed to. So we are dedicating a little over 2.5% of our vineyard land to understanding what grape varieties are grown in warmer climates that may be appreciable to the Napa Valley.
We're talking to Dan Petrosky, winemaker at Larkmead Vineyard in Napa Valley. So specifically, what do you do to try and, I don't know, get as close to the Cabernet as possible?
What we did, or as we thought about this process at Larkmead, was to think about the grape varieties that can play the supporting role in lifting up Cabernet Sauvignon's core. We're looking for siblings here. We're not looking for alternative varieties and saying that this is the new grape of Napa Valley 20 or 30 years from now. We're looking for things that are really kind of in the line that make very similar style wines that we see here in California and the Napa Valley in particular.
Which ones? What are those grapes?
We have a history with Zinfandel and Petite Syrah, which are two grapes that were planted at Larkmead and over the course of its 125 years. So we're working with those two grape varieties. At the time, they probably weren't the right grapes because the weather was slightly cooler. And we're looking at grape varieties like Tempranillo and Toriga Nacional in Portugal. We're looking at Syrah that's planted in the southern hemisphere in Australia. So we're basically looking at places that are that have experienced things that we're going to be experiencing en masse in the next few decades.
What kinds of wines could those grapes that you mentioned produce eventually?
We're hoping that they produce incredible Napa Valley red wines. Whether we have to attach our star to Cabernet Sauvignon is a question we'll have to ask ourselves moving forward. The next Cabernet Sauvignon doesn't necessarily need to be a Cabernet Sauvignon. It could be one of the grapes I mentioned earlier, or it could be a blended red wine.
We're talking to Dan Petrosky. He's with Larkmead Vineyard in Napa County. When you were interviewed by the San Francisco Chronicle about this, you mentioned that there are other winemakers right in your area who do not take this as seriously as you do, and you have. So why not?
None of these people are climate deniers. I think we all are living in an agricultural community and we're seeing the impact of climate on our day-to-day lives. But so I think some people have become numb to it. So we kind of get a little tied up in our day-to-day lives. And I think thinking 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years from now is something that we lose sight of at times. And so I think everyone believes in it. I just think that they're a little too busy to act on it.
So then what's your message to people out there who are not thinking about the future of their food and drink because of climate change? What should they be thinking about?
For me, I don't want to be necessarily the guy on a box screaming and yelling and being a loud mouth. I want to lead by example. And I think what I hope is that some of the research we do will actually help my neighbors and my peers in the industry. And I'm just trying to be, kind of thoughtful about the future and lead a little bit and by action and see if we can help people out.
That's Dan Petrosky, winemaker at Larkmead Vineyard in Napa Valley. Dan, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
Moving on, driving in Los Angeles is almost always fraught. Now, despite the city's efforts, traffic just seems to be getting worse. But options for avoiding it? Well, there aren't that many, which is why the mapping app Waze has been so popular. But it's not without issues. According to a new piece in the September edition of Los Angeles Magazine, the city streets are no longer controlled by the LA Department of Transportation. Instead, they're controlled by amateur map editors who seemingly have little regard for the havoc they wreak, sending multitudes of cars along corridors that were never meant to handle more than low-speed residential traffic. Jonathan Littman wrote the article. He joins us now. Jonathan, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure, Jonathan. All right. Waze first came to LA in 2011, and by 2014, it was being hailed as the solution to what had seemed like an unsolvable problem, traffic. So what's gone wrong?
It's a bit complicated, but the truth was, at the beginning, Waze seemed fantastic. Celebrities and movie stars loved it. They got places faster. But after a while, it backfired. There was this huge penetration of cell phones, right? So everyone had a cell phone, and, 80 or 90% had these apps. And there's something else really complicated here, which is, Los Angelinos know that it's a weird city. There are these huge freeways, and then there are, mountains and hills and tiny roads. And that's part of the problem, too.
Yeah, because those roads aren't meant for a lot of cars to be on them. Jonathan, your article focuses, though, on map editors. Waze sometimes uses crowdsourcing as a way to maybe get around certain issues. So, like, if I see an accident, I kind of report it. But how are the map editors maybe different than the crowdsourcing aspect of Waze?
Yeah, this is when you go deep. You volunteer, you know, for 20, 30, 40 hours a week, unpaid, incredibly. And then you're somebody who is able to actually designate streets as being open or closed to traffic. So you're actually influencing the algorithm as opposed to just noting a accident or something in real time. You're deciding that the traffic is going to go through someone's backyard, essentially.
So it's all like a godlike authority in a way over the LA streets.
It is, and I think that's why they're obsessed. That's why they have these handles, you know, like Skulls Code and Goober King, and they think they're hackers, and they really are. They're hacking traffic. These individuals can designate one of these tiny streets, which may have a speed limit of 15 or 20 or 25 miles an hour, as through traffic. And they actually will designate it the same way they would the 405.
Wow.
So traffic is a really complex engineering problem that shouldn't be given to guys with names like Dwarf Lord.
And the crazy thing is like the more they edit, it's like being a Boy Scout and getting a Boy Scout badge. The more they edit, the more they're elevated as map editors.
Exactly. So, you know, you start out at a level one. It's levels like a game. It's doubly bizarre because not only are they essentially opening a flow of traffic to a road never designed for traffic. But on top of that, you've got people in Porsches and Teslas going 40 in a 15.
Oof.
And then Waze actually models the algorithm off the illegal speed. So they're actually encouraging speeding through these neighborhoods with the algorithm.
We're talking to Jonathan Lippman, who wrote about the mapping app Waze for Los Angeles Magazine, the September issue. Now, lots of pretty horrifying stories in your piece. Let's focus on one. Tim Grant, he lives in the Hollywood Hills on a street that was really just battered with Waze traffic. Tell us what happened with Tim Grant.
Yeah, Tim's just a nice guy who lives there with his partner. And he suddenly noticed that this crazy traffic was going through on a street where I believe it's 20 to 25 miles an hour. Trucks are getting stuck on corners because, you know, everyone just follows this flow. So he tried to take the street off of the, you know, assigned algorithm. And, you know, what did Waze do? They had a lawyer go after him. You know, what's happened is there's lots of meetings and lots of communities across Los Angeles where people are standing up. And the algorithm, it's not good for the community.
Now, one thing I did not see in your story, Jonathan, is any response from Waze. Did they just decide they didn't want to participate in this?
Well, you know, it's funny. I called these people, and I got a guy from a branding firm, not even PR for Waze. And of course he said, yes, we'll have somebody from Waze talk to you. And they couldn't be bothered. And honestly, they can't bother to call the councilman in Los Angeles. So this is no big surprise.
Now, Waze briefly had a partnership with the city of LA. That was back in 2015. Well, what was that partnership with the city supposed to achieve and what ultimately happened?
Well, you know, in a perfect world, Google, Apple, you know, Waze could actually work with cities. But it was a one-way street. And then awful things were happening. Like during the wildfires, Waze was sending people toward the blaze.
Oh, wow.
Because the street was empty. And that's the sort of madness that has happened because there's not a collaboration between the city and these companies. And what's happened now is, you know, that deal ended and people like Councilman Krikorian and others are trying to have a real deal, demanding real partnerships.
So if Waze is causing as many problems as it solves, then what's the solution for getting traffic under control in Los Angeles?
You know, I think it would be actually be a true partnership between real traffic engineers and then companies that decide maybe the community matters. And I really believe that one of these companies is going to start to do the right thing, and then the others will follow.
Jonathan Lippman is the author of the article Car Wars in the September issue of Los Angeles Magazine. It's about the inner workings of Waze and how amateur map editors are wreaking havoc on LA's streets. Jonathan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, don't you just hate that guy at a party that has to ruin everything by pointing out facts about stuff? Has he not heard the time-honored saying, ignorance is bliss? He just pops bubbles on things such as why vitamin supplements are not healthful, or maybe on why building a border wall doesn't deter illegal immigration. Well, this guy is actually real and has a show where that's all he does, ruins everything. We'll meet him when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Adam ruins everything. Music, food, you name it. And that would be comedian, writer, and podcaster Adam Conover, who routinely debunks traditions and myths about American society on his True TV show, which just returned for its latest season. On the show, he unapologetically reveals the hidden truths behind everything from healthcare to drugs to politics.
Building a wall would actually increase the number of illegal immigrants in America. The Chargemaster is a secret document full of insane prices that hospitals use to charge us whatever they want. For most people, weed is essentially harmless.
Columbus couldn't have discovered that the Earth was round because in his time, it was already common knowledge.
Adam Conover is based in Los Angeles and joins us now in studio to maybe ruin this fine show. Take Two. Adam, welcome? I don't know. Should I welcome you or not?
Yeah, welcome me. Welcome me. I won't ruin the show unless you specifically ask me to.
Unless I challenge you to ruin the show. Yeah. All right. Now, for listeners who may not be familiar with what you do, you're often billed as an investigative comedian.
Yeah.
That reminded me of Mel Brooks in History of the World Part 1, where he says he's a stand-up philosopher. That kind
sure.
of that. I mean, the parallels are there a little bit. But as journalists, it sounds like a more fun version of what we do. So describe what you do for us.
Well, I want to be very clear. I'm not a journalist. I'm a comedian. Mm-hmm. But what I do is I take the work of journalists, scholars, academics, people like that, people who have discovered incredible things about the world that debunk our common misconception of how we think the world works, and I, you know, blow that up and take it wide to a big audience. You know, with and we use comedy, visual effects, jokes. In order to make these concepts come to life. So, you know, I'm not just sort of, you know, sitting behind a desk telling you, you know, the facts. I'm, you know, we illustrate it with sketch comedy characters appear. If we mention Teddy Roosevelt, you know, and what he did, you know, back in his day, we see him on camera doing that. And so by making it super visual, making it super funny, you know, we hope those ideas will stick. And I think they do.
There would be a million things you could probably do on your show, right, Adam? I mean,
oh,
how do you choose which ones to deconstruct or to ruin, actually?
Well, so we've got an incredible writing and research staff. And then we just ask them to pitch, hey, what is something incredible that you have learned that blew your mind recently, that violated your idea of how you think the world is supposed to work? And when people pitch those, if it makes us have that reaction in the room of like, oh, oh my God, I can't believe that's true. Are you kidding me? You know, then it goes up on our corkboard. So we're looking to bring that to our audience. The only difference is we do it with comedy.
I know it ruins in the title, but it's more like fact-checking, right? You are just kind of fact-checking things as opposed to ruining them.
Absolutely. And we...
I don't want to ruin your title of your whole show.
No. Well, the title is tongue-in-cheek, right? Because on the show, I'm always talking to another person, right? Yeah. And I'm dispelling their notions. So someone who is, you know, trying to help the poor by giving food to a food pantry. Right, I pop up and tell them, hey, you know what? If you really want to help out the food pantry, give them money because they can do a better job shopping for food than you can. And they can, you know, a dollar goes a lot further when a nonprofit is using it to buy in bulk versus you going out and shopping yourself and then donating the cans. Right. And that's momentarily uncomfortable to know. The person I tell that is like, oh, come on, you ruined it. I was feeling like I was doing a good thing. And now you're telling me I'm not. Ah, come on, jerk. Right. But the fact is, at the end of the day, it's better to know that thing, right? It, because that lets you give more effectively. Now that you know that, you can actually fulfill your goal better. And not only that, even though it's momentarily uncomfortable to find out that something that you believed is not true, ultimately it's pleasurable. It's fun. It's enjoyable, right? It's a good feeling.
Talking to Adam Conover, creator of the True TV show, Adam Ruins Everything. You've tackled a lot of things. President Trump's proposed border wall. You've also tackled subjects like healthcare, climate change, legalizing marijuana, all these things very much in the political zeitgeist right now. Mm-hmm. Is this about politics for you?
No, actually. Look, there's a lot of comedians doing very great work doing political comedy, right? Talking about the issues of the day or talking about, you know, the movement in political circles day to day. We don't do that. We talk about policies and we talk about ideas. So in our segment on the border wall, right, which we did prior to the 2016 election, we did not talk about Trump in that segment. And that segment was not about Trump for us because other people have proposed a border wall. It's not unique. You know, he certainly brought it into the zeitgeist, right, and made it a bigger topic. But this is something that people have been saying for decades, right? And so we wanted to break down. Here's why it would not work. And the reason it wouldn't work is really interesting and enlightens you on how immigration works in America generally. Because the thing you need to realize about a border wall is it would actually make illegal immigration, if you view that as a problem, it would actually exacerbate that problem. Because before we had heavy enforcement at the borders, people would migrate across the border back and forth, right? Because, you know, farm work is seasonal work. Mm-hmm. And so they would come across for the season, right? Do some, picking or whatever they would do, and then head back home, right? With some money in their pocket, right? That was sort of like a natural ebb and flow. Once we started enforcing the border more during the 80s, people started, it's tough to cross, so I'm not going to be able to go back and forth. So instead, I'll head into Arizona, Texas, wherever, and I'll set down roots, right? I will now live there. And so that turned what was once a migratory labor population into a permanent population. And we got that information from a professor who literally has been going down to the border since the 70s and conducting field research and asking people, when did you cross the border? You know, who did you come with, et cetera, right? Just doing a census of that population, right? And so this is the guy who knows, right? But nobody else is asking him. So that's what we do, right? We don't take a side in a political debate. We say, okay, here's something that people are talking about.
But can you hear how someone might think that's partisan, though? For someone that says that the border wall is essential to national security, it's essential for streamlining immigration, they're going to see and hear your argument and say, wait a second, how is this not political?
I completely disagree with that. Because I'm not taking a stance on the moral issue, right? or like what that person's emotional relationship to immigration is, right? Which is what is cleaving along partisan lines, right? I don't care what you think of the border wall. I want you to know that you misunderstand it, right? Both people from both parties misunderstand the border wall. We also did a segment on guns, right? Mm-hmm. And it was about how everybody misunderstands guns in America. And here, you know, on a number of different axes, and here are a number of different topics on which they misunderstand it. Now, if someone thinks that what I really take objection to is if someone thinks that us presenting the facts about immigration in America, the things that the people who actually research immigration know and that you should know if you want to address immigration, if by presenting that we're being partisan, that's a ridiculous idea. And someone who literally would try to keep information from themselves because it's partisan to learn it, what a bizarre thing to think. Yeah. You know?
Well, because we live in a world now, Adam, where the phrase alternative facts actually exists.
Sure. And that's, again, that's what I don't do, right? I don't do that day to day. You know, that's something that Kellyanne Conway said on the air like 3 years ago, right? And I don't get into that level of it. But look, my job is to look for this information, spread it, right? And hopefully it will inform those political discussions, right? But our job, what I aim to do is to go a level deeper and not talk about, oh, here's what he said, she said, here's what Scaramucci or whoever the hell did today, right? But to talk about, like, this is what you misunderstand. This is what we misunderstand as a culture. This is what we need to be more informed about. And these are the truths that we have a hard time accepting. Because once we have all of those in mind, once we understand those truths, then we can start to have actual conversations about policy, and then conversations about policy lead to political decisions. So we're trying to go a couple levels deeper than just, quote, politics.
All right, let's get into the 2020 election for a second. A lot of Americans are kind of looking at it with a combination of excitement and dread. What can you ruin for us with the 2020 election?
Oh, my gosh. You know, we've done a lot of material on the systemic problems in our election system, on gerrymandering, and how gerrymandering is a method by which the politicians choose the voters who are going to vote for them, and therefore figure out how to win elections before we even vote, right? Which functionally disenfranchises us. We've also done segments on the Electoral College, on how the Electoral College skews democracy by making some people's votes count far, far more than others, right? And that's not just like rural and urban, right? Because you can also talk about states like New Jersey and Rhode Island, which are largely urbanized states. These are eastern seaboard, mega city areas. But the people who live in those cities have outsized voting power versus like people who live in some rural states.
All right. So one more thing, as people prepare to enter what's sure to be an intense election cycle, what do you think they should keep in mind when it comes to what you do and what they might want to do at the voting booth?
That's a very good question. We have done a lot of topics on the show that, thankfully, I would say some politicians are starting to run on now. We've done a lot of segments about monopoly power, for instance, and how much monopoly power controls and constrains our lives, how even if you're a fan of capitalism, it distorts capitalism in negative ways. We had this fellow, Scott Galloway, on the show, who's an NYU business school professor and a startup founder, who says we need to break up these companies, Facebook, Amazon, et cetera, that they're too large and that they have too much control over our lives. That's bad for us as consumers. It's bad for our society. It's bad for capitalism, if capitalism is something that you value. And, you know, you're starting to see some candidates start to talk about that, what they're running on. So I'd say, you know, I hope that folks who watch our show, if they are convinced by our breakdown of the facts about these policy ideas, and then they see a politician match that policy idea, hey, give them a vote, right?
Adam Conover is the creator of the True TV show Adam Ruins Everything, which just returned for a new season. The show airs Tuesday night. Adam, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. Please watch.
When we think about neighborhoods being gentrified, it usually involves an influx of more affluent folks into a longtime area of residents who don't have the means to stop it from happening. Many are going to point to Highland Park, Echo Park. Coming up, there's another place in LA that's long been known as an enclave for a specific group of people. It's being gentrified in part because of a wider acceptance of that community. Find out where when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. There are neighborhoods around California that have become homes for the gay community. The Castro in San Francisco, Hillcrest in San Diego, and of course, West Hollywood, its own city near LA. Development, gentrification, and rising housing prices have changed many of these places. Now, as part of our California Dream collaboration, CalMatters' Elizabeth Aguilera looks at how West Hollywood is holding on to its gay residents.
Honestly, I like it. It's really shiny. The sequence is like a combination of like gold and a rainbow mix.
Manny Lopez models a sequin tank top at a store called Block Party in West Hollywood. His friend George Cortez isn't so sure.
I don't like it. I think it's kind of tacky.
The two are here from San Bernardino to shop, to eat, hang out. Lopez says they make the drive pretty regularly.
There's not a lot of spaces for queer people, so you kind of migrate anywhere that's like a mecca.
But the draw is changing. Technology makes it easier to find community and relationships and sparkly tank tops online. There's more acceptance of the LGBTQ community and more places people can be comfortable with their partners.
The need to sort of band together and to bolster one another is changing.
Alex Bitterman is a professor at Alfred State in New York. He's writing a book about changing gayborhoods.
I don't think it's going away, but the way that we as an isolated or an ostracized LGBT community has been treated is changing.
And as the appeal of the neighborhood shifts, so does the neighborhood itself. Over the last few years, a steady march of mainstream restaurants, bars, and other retail have moved into West Hollywood. Wealthy young professionals are renting and buying here. Block Party is one of a handful of gay-centric places left. Larry Block owns the store.
The whole street turned into bars and restaurants, and we're like the soldier here holding up the gayborhood and, you know, being the place you can get a pride flag.
He recognizes that some of the change is related to the gentrification and high housing prices affecting neighborhoods across the state. And he puts some of the responsibility on the city of West Hollywood.
We're just becoming a big city. You know, money comes in, developments come in, business comes in, the restaurants come in, the city zoned it so that, you know, you could have one restaurant and bar after another and kick out every single retailer.
West Hollywood Mayor John D'Amico pushes back against the idea the city is losing its gay identity. He cites a survey showing West Hollywood is still about 45% LGBTQ. It's mainly gay men.
We haven't, in fact, lost our identity as an LGBTQ center for Los Angeles. What has happened is that many, many, many people have just sort of hunkered down. They have a rent-controlled apartment or they purchased a house.
And many of those who've hunkered down are older.
We are actually, again, a sort of new cultural defining moment. We are the first naturally occurring LGBT retirement community.
The city is focused on an aging-in-place program, helping residents stay in the community and live the life they came here to have, their version of the famed California dream.
California has long sought to make itself a place that welcomes people who perhaps would feel more marginalized in other places.
Gary Gates is a retired UCLA researcher who studies LGBTQ neighborhoods.
Apart from the kind of Brady Bunch version of the California dream, it always has been one of people kind of going to a new place where they could feel more free and open and accepted.
And Larry Block says that acceptance remains part of the appeal.
They find West Hollywood and they realize, you're okay. You're welcome here. We got you. You know, we may not be able to house you, but we got you. You're amongst your own. I think that's the most beautiful part of the community.
From West Hollywood, I'm Elizabeth Aguilera.
All right, let's end on a note that hopefully won't leave you too deflated. Our listeners in Orange County may be familiar with the huge Great Park Balloon in Irvine. Since 2007, the park has offered rides on the 400-foot-high balloon that offers panoramic views of the county and park for up to 30 people. But now it's having a little trouble, pardon the pun, staying afloat. Blame it on the global shortage of helium and increased operating costs. The attraction is projected to run a $1 million deficit over the next year. Irvine officials must now find outside financial support for the giant orange orb. They're even considering corporate sponsors. If they can't find the support, well, the treasured balloon could be grounded for good. Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to ride? Maybe not. It needs some cash, so help it out. All right. If you missed any part of today's show, just go to wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll be right there smiling right back at you. You can also find us on social media at Take Two, at Take Two. I'm there as well, at AMartinezLA. I'm also there on Instagram, at AMartinezLA. Today, I actually matched my shirt with a unicorn. So take a look at that picture coming up in just a bit. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.